This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at the Newseum, Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and the news business. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama trade barbs and campaign ads over bitter and cling. They're gearing up for their 22nd debate tonight in Philadelphia, with the Pennsylvania primary just 6 days away, and John McCain calls for a holiday from the gas tax just in time for summer. It's Wednesday, and no matter where we are, we've got to get our weekly hit of the political junkie.
There you go again.
My name is Geraldine Ferraro.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
I'm John Kerry, and I'm reporting for duty.
But I'm the decider.
Every Wednesday, NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us, and of course this week he followed the trail of breadcrumbs down here to the Newseum. In addition to the Democratic Donnybrook, new opinion polls show some effect from Senator Obama's remarks to fundraisers in San Francisco. Senator David Vitter is not called to testify in the D.C. Madam trial, and Senator Arlen Specter announced that his cancer has recurred. If you want to get on the conversation, if you're in Pennsylvania, call and tell us how the Democratic primary contest looks from where you sit. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, we'll get the story behind the story of the New York Times decision to hold and then finally publish the story of the warrantless wiretaps. But first, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us here in the Knight Studio at the Newseum. We tried hiding from you, but you found us anyway. And as always, you have a trivia question for us.
I do. This is the first time we've ever done the show fully dressed, which I thought was very interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'm sitting here. We're going to talk to Barry Goldwater Jr. later, whose father, ironically, was Barry Goldwater.
Uh-huh.
And I have a Barry Goldwater trivia question. Now, some of the questions are pretty easy. This is a tough one. When Barry Goldwater was elected to the Senate in 1952, he did something that no Senate challenger has done since. That's a question that...
That's a question. And if you know the answer, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Well, here's my cell phone.
Okay.
Or send us an email, talk@npr.org. Barry Goldwater Jr., don't tell us if you know the answer, but do you know the answer?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yes.
All right. We have verification right here at the table with us. Barry Goldwater Jr. and John Dean will be with us later to talk about their new book about Barry Goldwater Sr. And, let's get right to the politics. Obama's comments on the bitterness of American working class people who, he said, cling to religion and guns to vent their frustrations. I guess this is beginning to show at least some effect in the polls in Pennsylvania.
Well, actually, some polls show that Hillary Clinton maintained a 6-point lead, which she had in other polls a week ago, although polls in Pennsylvania seem to be all over the lot. In one poll, she has up by 15 points. There's one poll that has Obama up by 2 points. So it's really, and as we've said over and over again, polls on the day of the New Hampshire primary had Obama winning handily. So we kind of discount the polls, even though it's only 6 days away. But having said that, there is some residual effect, if not in Pennsylvania, where, of course, most people took those remarks to heart, but also among Democrats who are suddenly getting nervous about what Barack Obama might mean as a Democratic nominee in November.
And, of course, it's been the subject of campaign ads in Pennsylvania. Let's listen first to a bit from the Hillary Clinton ad about the cling and bitter issue.
I was very insulted by Barack Obama.
It just shows how out of touch Barack Obama is.
I'm not clinging to my faith out of frustration and bitterness. I find that my faith is very uplifting.
The good people of Pennsylvania deserve a lot better than what Barack Obama said.
Hillary does understand the citizens of Pennsylvania better.
Hillary Clinton has been fighting for people like us her whole life.
And, of course, the following day, the Obama campaign put out a reply ad.
I know that many of you, like me, were disappointed by recent remarks that he made.
There's a reason people are rejecting Hillary Clinton's attacks, because the same old Washington politics won't lower the price of gas or help our struggling economy. Barack Obama will represent all Americans. He offers a new approach.
And Ken Rudin, all of that in preparation for tonight's debate, 6 days from Election Day in Pennsylvania, the last chance really to make, I guess, an impression with voters.
Well, you know, it's funny. The last debate we had was February 26th, and at that time we said, enough already. It seemed like there was a debate every 5 minutes, and it was just inundated with it. And now so much has happened since February 26th. Barack Obama's speech on race, which followed Jeremiah Wright's, the comments that we found out what Jeremiah Wright was having to say. Hillary Clinton being under attack, but maybe not being under attack at the tarmac in Tuzla. Say that one time fast.
Tarmac and Tuzla.
Exactly. So there are a lot of things that have happened since that last debate. And, of course, with 6 days to go before Pennsylvania, it's a state that she has to win. There is pressure on her to get out. She trails in the delegates. She trails in the popular vote. She certainly trails in the number of states won. But at the same time, she'll say, well, wait a second. If I'm going to win Pennsylvania, I could win Indiana, Kentucky, West Virginia coming up in the next couple of weeks. Why should I be out of the race if some polls show that I could be the strongest Democrat in November? And that's the battle that the Democrats are going through right now. Which one could beat John McCain?
And Barney Frank, who is a supporter of Hillary Clinton, said after June 3rd, after the last primary vote comes through, at that point, whoever's in the lead, we should defer to whoever he or she is. That should be the nominee.
More and more Democrats are saying that, and it's interesting that Barney Frank said that. For one, as you say, he's a Hillary supporter. His sister is Ann Lewis, a longtime Hillary Clinton advisor. And I think everybody feels that as of June 3rd, no matter what happens in the next 9 contests after Pennsylvania, it's hard to imagine Hillary Clinton with any kind of lead. So it's almost like saying that we have to go with what happens after June 3rd. Now, some Clinton people say, no, let's fight to the convention. Let's fight for the delegates that we should have in Michigan and Florida, which currently do not count. So there's no sign of any kind of bowing out yet, but there are more and more Democrats who say enough already. June 3rd is the cutoff date.
And Ken, you may have come up with a trivia question that's just a little bit too tough. Nobody's calling with an answer to what did Barry Goldwater accomplish at his first Senate campaign that has not been accomplished since. So give us a little hint, maybe.
Well, the hint was, this will really give it away, especially with the studio audience. Ready? His opponent was Ernest McFarland. Huh? Yeah. Well, anyway, no. But the point is, the fact that you have to know who Ernest McFarland was, and that's why he's the last person to accomplish this feat. I tell you, the phones are now ringing off the hook.
800-989-8255 and email us talk@npr.org. In the meantime, there was, of course, a lot of talk about a Clinton-Obama or Obama-Clinton ticket. There is nonetheless some speculation now about another consolation prize.
Well, the New York Times reports today that there are some people who are trying to get Hillary Clinton, if she drops out of the race, to perhaps run for governor of New York in 2010. Now, of course, that's not going to happen. The last rumor a month ago was that she was going to drop out of the race and push Harry Reid aside and be the Senate Majority Leader. Apparently, Ted Kennedy is among the Senate Democrats who have been talking to people about that possibility. Harry Reid says, first of all, I can't give up the seat. If I'm no longer Majority Leader, it'll hurt my reelection prospects in 2010, and he will have a tough reelection in 2010. So that's not going to happen. New York Times reports that Hillary Clinton would push David Paterson, who is New York State's first African-American governor, out of the way to run for governor. Again, I mean, the Clinton campaign calls it preposterous. It is, but again, it's one of those increasing rumors about her lot in life after this campaign.
800-989-8255. Let's get a caller on the line. This is Robert, and Robert's with us from Cincinnati.
Regarding Obama's bitter comment, first of all, I'm wondering whether your political analyst feels that that segment of the population is truly bitter. I wish they were bitter about the war and the economy, but I don't see a lot of discontent. And secondly, I'm wondering whether it could help independent voters support Obama in the sense that I am not pro-God, I'm anti-gun, and I'm pro-gay. I didn't comment on gay, but that right-wing part of the conservative party, I think people are tired of that. Could it actually help Obama for that kind of honesty in his comments?
Well, they're not tired of it in Pennsylvania. I mean, obviously, guns and God, and I'm not throwing that out as a slogan. It's very important to rural voters, to socially conservative voters, and it's not something they – Barack Obama is not going to stand up and say, I am pro-gay and I am anti-gun, whether or not he or Hillary Clinton may have those views on guns.
And it's interesting when John McCain, during the Michigan primary, when there were still Republicans running against him, said, these jobs are not coming back. Well, it didn't seem to help him with independent voters in Michigan.
Right. He was honest about that, and he lost the primary, too. But, of course, Mitt Romney, who beat him, is nowhere to be found.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call, Robert.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can go. Here's a proposed trivia answerer. This is Jerry with us from University Heights.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I'm going to take a stab here. Did he beat an incumbent of the same party?
No. Barry Goldwater was a Republican, and he defeated Ernest McFarland, of course, who was a Democrat incumbent. Okay. But there was something about that race that has not happened since.
Thanks for the idea, Jerry.
I thought that Ernest McFarland would give it away.
I don't know. Yeah. Let's see if Marshall has the answer. Marshall's calling us from Chicago.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
I believe that Barry Goldwater defeated a sitting majority leader, and that has not happened since.
Ding, ding, ding.
That is correct.
All right.
I knew that Ernest McFarland would give the way. Now, Tom Daschle was defeated in 2004, but he was a minority leader, defeated by John Thune. But Ernest McFarland, as Neil, as you well remember,
of course,
was the last sitting majority leader defeated for re-election.
And we should also point out an email by the name of Daniel got us that answer, too. And thanks very much for that. Marshall, appreciate it.
Thank you.
And a couple of other items. What does this town come to when you have a good madam trial, a prostitution scandal, and not one politician is called to testify?
Well, it's hard to imagine a politician from Louisiana winding up on a madam's list, but David Vitter, the Republican, the pro-family Republican senator from Louisiana, was on the list, but he is not going to have to testify, and that's to his benefit. A lot of some Democrats have said, like James Carville, who's from Louisiana, has said it's kind of interesting that Vitter gets off the hook. He stays in the Senate, while people like Elliot Spitzer, I love we're comparing scandals here, but Elliot Spitzer had to resign his office. But again, I think it's more about hypocrisy than anything else.
And just a few seconds left, but Alan Keyes is leaving the Republican Party.
My God. Alan Keyes, who's been running for president to the excitement of millions, announced this week, actually yesterday, that he's leaving the Republican Party. He's going to run for president on the Constitution Party. It's a third party, and Constitution Party holds its convention in Kansas City.
I think it's about the fifth party, actually.
Yeah, actually, there are a lot of third parties, like Bob Barr, the former Republican congressman, may be the Libertarian Party nominee.
Ken, stay with us. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Barry Goldwater Jr. and John Dean about Barry Goldwater. Here's an excerpt from the book, The Watergate, it's beginning to be like Teapot Dome. I mean, there's a smell to it. Let's get rid of that smell. We're live at the Knight Studio at the Newseum here in Washington, D.C., 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting live today from the Knight Studio inside the Newseum in Washington, D.C. In 1964, Barry Goldwater led the Republican Party to one of the most lopsided defeats in American political history, but his ideas sparked a movement. He openly rejected the legacy of the New Deal, which he felt bordered on socialism, and he wasn't afraid to take on liberals in his own party as well. The state of Arizona returned him to the U.S. Senate, and during the Watergate scandal, Goldwater was one of the party elders who urged Richard Nixon to resign as president. In the 1980s, he saw many of his conservative beliefs vindicated by the election of Ronald Reagan. The life and career of Barry Goldwater is the subject of a fascinating new book assembled by his son, former California Congressman Barry Goldwater Jr., and John Dean, whose own role in Nixon's demise is also well known. The two spent time poring over Senator Goldwater's diaries and writings, some of which predate World War II, and the result is pure Goldwater, surprising and candid. Both John Dean and Barry Goldwater are here with us today at the Newseum. Welcome. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
And if any of you have questions about the ideas and the influence of Barry Goldwater, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Barry Goldwater Jr., Theodore White once wrote that your father spoke with the unrestrained candor of old men and little children. With a subject so famously frank in public, some people might be amazed that there's so much material he kept private.
Well, his personal thoughts, his personal feelings, he kept very private. And that's what's so exciting about pure Goldwater, that for the first time, his introspective, unvarnished details of in the back rooms of politics is coming to the front for the people to see. He served with some seven presidents and knew them all intimately, and had various relations with them.
And liked one or two.
And liked one or two.
John Dean, what did you learn going through this material? You've obviously known Barry Goldwater. You guys went to school together.
We did.
So you've known each other for a very long time. What did you learn about his father that you didn't know?
Well, I think one of the big things that really caught me, and I asked Barry right away if he was aware of this after we discovered the material,
that his father had been offered the vice presidency by Gerald Ford and turned it down. In fact, Goldwater was the first choice. I didn't also know, in fact, I was surprised to find that in this private journal, a really almost a disproportionate amount really deals with Nixon and Watergate. Mm-hmm. And he has all these very complex relations and emotions and feelings about Nixon, where he finally cuts him loose at the end, but it's very hard for him to do. But the fact that Nixon had offered him an ambassadorship before, long before Watergate became as vital to Nixon as it was, and had promised the last 2 years of his term that he could go to Mexico and serve, and he never told anybody. And this obviously had to influence when he withdrew his defense of Nixon. He was withdrawing his chance to ever go to Mexico and serve as ambassador. So that really shows what a straight shooter he was, that those sorts of politics didn't influence this man, and that really comes through in everything in this book.
Hmm. Another thing that we find out about him, he is regarded as, well, the father or the grandfather, depending on how you look at it, of American conservatism, but it was not an unalloyed, some parts of the conservative movement were not necessarily to his liking.
Is that to be?
Oh, yeah. either way.
Well, I'll jump in very quickly. One of the reasons we found this whole journal is that I was actually working on a book with the senator who did have some feelings about what was going on. He didn't like the incivility in the movement. He was a little troubled by the religious right and the influence it was getting. And so we talked about doing a book together before he happened to get ill, and so we never did it. But at that time he said, John, look at my papers. And lo and behold, when I did, I found this journal that he had kept periodically throughout his entire adult life, where he either initially with a portable typewriter, or later when dictating machine became available, he's flying either his own plane or as a passenger, he's constantly dictating. And some reason, his autobiographies that were written with co-authors or his biographies were written never really got to this material. So I got the Arizona Historical Foundation. I said, Barry, we've got pure gold here, as we later called pure gold water, because this is the voice of the man we knew, and it's a much different voice than comes out in other forums.
What fascinates me about this book is that, you know, you always talk about how much the Republicans and the conservatives idolize Barry Goldwater, and yet his candid thoughts throughout the whole book on Eisenhower, on Joe McCarthy, on Richard Nixon as early back as 1959, there were a lot of ambiguities as far as he felt about other Republicans. And yet it's more liberals now who cherish Barry Goldwater, perhaps because of his views on government intervention and drug policy and things like that. But do you see the irony, both of you, do you see the irony that it's the liberals who seem to reward and cherish Barry Goldwater more than ever?
I think John could talk to that.
There's no question that when, by the time he passed away, he was left of center by Republican standards. And he was aware of that. He joked about it. In fact, at one point when Bob Dole was running for president, he and Dole met with the press and said, we're now the liberals of the Republican Party. So he had fun with it. But it is ironic, and it shows that the views he formed very early and the foundations he drew upon were just unchangeable to him, and he stayed with them, and regardless of the cost. Things like his pro-choice position, for example. Long before Roe v. Wade, he believes a woman has a right of choice. And because of his libertarian feelings, he doesn't change that position. And this goes issue after issue. Now, yes, he's consistent on wants smaller government, very typical conservative position. Many of them are well recognized. But I think one of the things that bothered him most about where the movement went was the tone of incivility that crept into conservative politics.
I think my dad had a profound respect for the individual, and he spent much of his political career fighting for the right of an individual to be left alone. He truly was a libertarian in that respect. He felt that the genius of our Constitution, our founding fathers, was founded on individuals' responsibility, individuals taking care of themselves. And he had tremendous faith. He also was a religious man. My father believed in God, and when I was younger, he used to take us camping. We would walk through the forest, and he would tell us that that when he walks through the forest, he's walking with God, and that there's more strength and decency in one pine tree that you'll find in a lot of people.
Hmm.
He believed in a higher power, but he didn't believe that you needed to put God on your bumper sticker. And he had problems with the religious right kind of skewing what the real conservative philosophy was about. And that was the individual, the individual's right to decide and to be left alone to decide. And such things as religion should not be a qualification to run for political office. And I'm looking back at the Republican primary, and so much of the time was spent each of those candidates defining their religious views. I think we've gotten way off, and I think my father would agree, way away from true politics and true government.
Let's see if we get a caller in on the conversation. Again, 800-989-8255. And Mark is with us. Mark calling us from Silver Lake. And where is Silver Lake, Mark?
Silver Lake, Ohio, near Kent State University.
Okay.
I am one of those liberals whose admiration for Barry Goldwater Sr. is unbounded. It took me a long time to realize what kind of man he was. But my question is, I should say, too, that because I am a liberal, there are many issues with which I disagreed with your father. But my question to Congressman Goldwater is, do you think a man of such fierce integrity like your father and such honesty stands a chance today in national politics? And I'll be happy to take my answer off the air.
All right, Eric. Mark, thanks for the call.
I think the country is desperately looking for leadership of this magnitude, the Ronald Reagans, the Barry Goldwaters, people who stand up and don't test the wind or take a poll, but truly say what's in his heart. And he once told me as a young boy growing up, he said, the mark of a true person is somebody that stands up and says what he thinks and is willing to stay with it. And too oftentimes we have a lot of cliches. I was listening to Obama talking in his speech about we have a new approach. Well, what does that tell you? Tell us what he means by that. Mm. Let's fill in the gaps. Let's get some meat in this political. Let's ask these candidates what they really are going to do for this country. But we've lost track of that. We're looking, I think, desperately for that type of leadership.
John Dean?
I might add that in the journals at one point, the senator does explain that he's very concerned about two things. One, if a candidate can win by telling the truth, and another, of course, is campaign finance. He's concerned that the amount of money that's going into presidential races is getting out of hand. But the truth element is something that troubled him very much, that as he was watching late races after his own in 64, where he was brutally frank and sometimes quipped jokes like, well, maybe we ought to chuck a bomb into the men's room in Moscow and at the Kremlin, and things like that got him in a lot of trouble for being overly candid at times.
Let's get a question from the audience here at the museum.
My name is Seamus Campbell. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. Congressman Goldwater, your father is considered the father of the modern conservative movement. However, he had taken many libertarian, even liberal positions, many opposing the Reagan Republicans. In your opinion, what caused the change in views from the two eras?
No change.
I don't think there's been that much of a change.
Not in him.
Not in my father. I think he's been very consistent. I would call him a libertarian, limited government, less taxes, less intrusion. If you look around today to the average small businessman, all the regulations and reports and licenses that they have, it's very difficult for our entrepreneurial free enterprise system to really exist. My father was opposed to all that. On the other hand, he believed in foreign policy that you have to deal from strength. I don't think that he would agree with our foreign policy today where we become the policemen of the world, that we have troops stationed all around the world. We're getting involved in the Middle East, as we did in Vietnam, with cultures we don't understand. But he truly believed that our country needed to be strong, and that's one basic requirement under the Constitution that our federal government do, and that is to provide for a strong defense.
Barry Goldwater Jr. and John Dean are the co-authors of the new book, Pure Goldwater. They're with us here at the museum, along with political junkie Ken Rudin. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And let's get another question again here at the museum.
Good afternoon. My name is Melinda Langford, and I'm from here in Alexandria, Virginia. And my question is, on domestic issues, what was your father's position on civil rights and the right to vote?
Melinda, long before the Civil Rights Vote Act of 1964 in Phoenix, Arizona, when he was ran his family business and was on the city council, he was a member of the NAACP, and he desegregated the Air National Guard, the airport, and the motion picture theaters. So he was brought up by his father to believe that, and it's in this book, Pure Book Goldwater, that his father told him that that treat everyone equal, that everyone is born equal, and treat them with kindness and consideration, and watch out for your fellow man. Try to do something nice for somebody else. Early in the first pages of the book, it talks about his upbringing and the influence of his family on treating people equally.
Was he in favor of the Civil Rights Act?
He voted against the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and he voted on it not because he was opposed to it. He was opposed to the process. He was a constitutionalist, and he felt that this was a state's rights responsibility, and that's the reason he voted against it.
I had some interesting conversations with a senator that Melinda might be interested in about this issue. I was in law school at the time the 64 campaign or 64 civil rights bill came to the floor of the Senate, and actually went up to watch the vote, and I was kind of surprised by the vote that he voted against the public accommodation section. He said, I don't really have trouble with other sections of the bill. It's the public accommodation section. So years later, I asked him, I said, you know, that was a very expensive vote for you. What gives? Why did you take that position? He said, well, I had what I thought was pretty good advice from two pretty good lawyers. One was a young lawyer in Phoenix by the name of Bill Rehnquist, and the other one was a Yale professor by the name of Robert Bork. One, of course, would go on to be the Chief Justice, and the other would be rejected to be on the court.
but gave us forever the verb to be borked.
That's right, he did.
But is it fair to say, though, that Goldwater's vote against the 64 Civil Rights Act was one of the reasons why the southern states, the whites who ran the votes in the southern states,
no question,
voted for Goldwater in 64 and led to...
Nixon watched this very closely. Nixon's southern strategy develops after watching the 64 campaign. He sees that indeed, one of the interesting things also Goldwater recognizes very quickly when he goes to the Senate, which are both big tent Republican and big tent Democratic parties, that they have wings, and he thinks some of the Republicans might belong better into the Democratic Party, and some of the Democrats might be in the Republican Party more comfortable. So he recognizes this dichotomy very early, and he recognizes the politics of it. And these are, of course, the states that did vote for him in the 64 campaign. But others, when he didn't exploit it the way the Southern strategy was later exploited. He revealed it.
Let's see if we get one last caller in. This is Michael. Michael with us from Plymouth. Is that Plymouth, Massachusetts?
No, it's Plymouth, Michigan.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, this is for the Congressman Goldwater. My great uncle was Carl Hayden, who, as you know, served a great many years with your father in the Senate representing the state of Arizona. Of course, on the other side of the aisle, but I am wondering what your father's take was on their relationship, because it seemed like in the time that they served, while they were a Democrat and Republican and differed on views, there was a I think they had a great mutual respect for one another, and there was a not the deep partisanship that you see in American politics today, that I think they both served the state of Arizona very, very well.
And I'm going to have to ask you to respond in about 30 seconds.
Well, Arizona was always conservative, whether you were Democrat or Republican. In fact, that's how my dad became a Republican. He and his brother flipped a coin to see, because they were in the clothing business, and one had to be a Democrat and the other one a Republican. and my dad lost and had to become the Republican. But he and Carl Hayden, and one of his jobs was to stop people from running against Carl Hayden. But Carl Hayden was is a monument in Arizona.
Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
John Dean and Barry Goldwater, the new book is called Pure Goldwater, and of course, Ken Rudin, our political junkie. You can read his column at npr.org, and he'll probably be back with us next Wednesday, do you think? All right.
Completely dressed.
Stay with us. We're going to talk about how the Times got the wiretap story. This is NPR News.